Sorry to interrupt a good conversation, but we have an opportunity to talk with HB Charles, and I think we've got a microphone here where you can come and stand and ask your question. And if you don't ask questions, I am going to ask questions because I've got things I want to ask HB about. But feel free to pop up at any time during the conversation. Just come stand at the mic. I'll recognize you, and we can talk. But I thought, I asked HB if he has had a chance to tell you a little bit about how the Lord worked in his life and his own sense of call to the ministry. And I think that'd be a good place to start. So, HB, would you tell us just a little bit about your Christian experience and your call to the ministry?
Sure. So I grew up in a preacher's home, and I may have mentioned my father was the pastor, my mother was the minister of music, and that basically means, among other things, that I lived in church. And I would say I have older siblings who rebelled against, I watched their rebellion against that. And I just knew that this was the life that we didn't have a choice about this. So I just had to make the best of the situation, and I just listened. I took those moments as a child seriously, and I guess all the cool kids sat in the overflow. I was forced to sit up front with the deacons. So, and I had, to be honest with you, Sunday school teachers. As a very little boy who had a very direct impact on my life, and they loved me, they prayed for me, and they kept sharing the gospel with me, I really felt they were picking on me because I was the preacher's kid. I look back now and am grateful for those dear brothers and sisters. And as a boy, I trusted the gospel. I know people who have similar testimonies to mine who, you know, go back and question about when exactly that happened or whether or not. But I could tell you that when I trusted Christ as a child, the rest of my life, that just have been stammering forward to follow him. As a boy, not too long after, I might have mentioned, I just sensed a call to preach. And at 11 years old, I was convinced. I don't know what the details of my life would be, but I was convinced I would spend my life preaching the gospel. And just harassed my father and the men around him to give me an opportunity to say something. And they relented. They gave me like 5 minutes at the end of the children's choir's musical. One afternoon, they were hedging their bets. And they're like, we're going to give them 5 minutes up here, and this will be over with, and we don't have to hear anymore. Man, I came to preach, you know. Yeah, they kept a very close eye on me, and they nurtured me. I spent quite a great deal of time with my father, and my faith was being nurtured. I think by being with him, he was, without me kind of knowing it, teaching me about ministry. He passed away when I was 16 years old. By that time, I was preaching. Often, my father pastored one of the respected churches in the city, and he would often visit other churches in town, but they would be very, very small churches. And he would tell us, we are intentionally going to be a blessing to churches that cannot be a blessing in return. And there are men all over Los Angeles who wanted a way to pay my father back and did not have a way to pay my father back. And they tried to pay my father back by preaching his son. And so I just felt like a city of preachers. To this day, whenever I go home to Los Angeles, I talk, you know, I'd say the prodigal son's coming back home. I'm grateful that the men of that city don't view me that way. And they are grateful for what God is doing in my life. And I am grateful for them because of the investment that they made in me after my father's death. He took my father and gave me a lot of fathers in the ministry who just watched over me, fussed at me, encouraged me, challenged me, taught me. I was called to serve that church at the age of 17, a year or so later. And just not only the city, but that local church prayed for me and watched over me. About a year out, the next thing I would say is about a year or so in, my dad pastored a very traditional Baptist church. About a year in and a half into my ministry, there's a morning prayer meeting from 6 to 7 every morning. Still happens in that church to this day. Somebody showed up with copies of Good Morning Holy Spirit. And a lot of weird things started breaking out in the church. And I did not know how to respond. And I am thumbing through Moody Magazine and see an advertisement for a book called Charismatic Chaos. And I go to a bookstore, and I've never had an experience like this ever. I go in a bookstore, and I say, do you have any books by somebody named John MacArthur? And the young lady behind the desk said, yeah, we got his books, but you don't want his books because he don't believe in the gifts. I had never been in a bookstore before or after with somebody to tell me not to buy a book that they were selling. And literally, John MacArthur's books were in the back on the floor, not on a shelf. But she went and got me the copy of the book, and I read it, and I just went back and bought all the stuff. Wherever I had some money, I went and bought all this stuff and was reading it. And just one day asked where Sun Valley was. And my sister, who lived like 2 miles away from Grace Community Church, was like, boy, that's right down the street.
Wow.
And I started hanging out at Grace Community Church on Sunday nights, which was shaping me for expositional preaching, shaping my theological convictions, shaping my philosophy of ministry. And that's a key, another element I would have to say to my spiritual development and walk and testimony that kind of just led to much of kind of where I landed at this point.
HB, how old were you when you preached your first sermon?
I was 11. I told you it was.
Anybody here beat that?
I told the story to the interns at the church last night. My dad asked, what are you going to. So they were only giving me 5 minutes at the end of this musical. And he asked me what I wanted to talk about. My dad had a weekly meeting Mondays. Tuesdays, I should say, was for the associate ministers of his church and pastors from the city. He would talk about leadership, preaching. He would preview what he was working on that week. And every week, he would go around that room and ask, what are you working on? And the associate ministers who didn't get many shots, he expected every week to hear that we were working on text. And I would sit there. And he asked, so you let me sit in, and this is the first time I'm involved. And he asked me, what are you going to work on for that? And I told him, I want to preach about the three Hebrew boys. Daniel, 3. And he said, I don't allow any of the guys who are doing their first message to preach anything outside the Gospels. You need to pick a Gospel text. And I was determined to preach on the three Hebrew boys. So we keep going back and forth. I am 11 years old. And he asked me how my preparation is going, and it is going great, but I am preparing Daniel 3. When he finally finds out, and we're getting close to this Sunday, my dad spends a week writing a piece for me. on the gospel passage of Jesus passing by the blind man. The sermon was entitled, Jesus is Passing By. And he's just like, you just get up and read this. And I get up, man, and I read the first couple of paragraphs of this introduction. And at the end of the second paragraph, and it's, you know, and it says, and in the same way, Jesus is passing by. And when I kind of get that punchline at the end of that second paragraph, you know, it's a Black Baptist church. So they're like, hey, man, come on now, take your time. And so I had a moment to pause. And I said, you know, I looked up from reading. I said, you know what? He passed by for the three Hebrew boys one day. And I spent the next 20 minutes preaching the sermon I prepared. I did not get another chance for a long time after that. But that was my first message. Yeah. I learned that day you do what you are asked to do when you get up.
That's really good. HB, ever since I've known you, I have known you as a voracious reader.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting next to HB during the Gospel Coalition has a council meeting that meets every other year, and typically we bring in some expert to try and help us in some particular area of theology to think about what's going on. In that particular year, Scott Swain from RTS Orlando and Carlton Wynn, an RTS Charlotte graduate who teaches at Westminster Seminary, were brought in to give short lectures on the Trinity and then to have a Q&A with everybody present. Well, I was sitting next to HB, who had his laptop open, and he was not only taking notes, but every book that Scott Swain recommended, he popped open his Amazon account and ordered it right there. So it was there waiting for him at home, you know, when he got back after the lecture. So ever since I've known him, he's a voracious reader. Did you get that from your daddy, or where did that come from?
My dad was my mental image of my father at home is a book in his hand or stacks of books everywhere. My dad just read. And he encouraged me to read. So, you know, in Black church culture, there is this notion of hooping and singing preachers, and that's been a mark of the tradition of the Black church. And my dad did not want that. He didn't want me going anywhere near that. My wife and I were talking about this week. He regularly would say, I do not want you to be a stereotype. I want you to be a preacher who can stand anywhere. And he just would force books on me. My father wouldn't answer Bible questions for me. I would ask him, I never will forget. I was like, Dad, if my people, which are called by my name, would humble themselves, where is that? My dad said, yeah, I don't know. But on my desk, there's a book called The Concordance. If you bring it to me, I'll show you how to find it. And I'm like, but no, you could just tell me where it is. And he's like, no, I can't. He said, so you got really two options. You can go get the book, or you can call Reverend Banks and ask him where it is. Reverend Banks was his, Russell Banks was his assistant pastor. And I went and called Russell Banks. And asked him. But, I mean, he was pushing me, the biblical illustrator. He would just encourage me to read. And at a certain point, it clicked. And then also in the providence of God, I suffered. After I started preaching, my asthma just got worse. And it's like my daddy would say, boy, if you walk out the door, you have an asthma attack. So my world was kind of inside, and so it ended up being a world of books, which kind of landed me on one book. And then, after my dad's death, and I finished high school, I got an ad for a college starting down the street from Knott's Berry Farm in Anaheim, California, from some professors who left Fuller Theological Seminary because of concerns. And it was just getting off the ground. And I went out there and started taking classes, and it was fledgling. It had just getting started. I'm telling you, I would get phone calls on, like, in the morning. The president was on the phone calling my house, and he says, "You know, HB, we don't have enough students for this class to float. Could you come out and take this class?" And I did. But these were, after I stopped attending there, all of those men remained in my life. And so when something would come up in the church, I would say, I would just call Joe Lamusio and James Bohr and ask them, "Hey, this came up, what should I read?" And they're like, "HB, you have to have this, 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 this." I have been blessed. I pastored a smaller church for 18 years. I pastor a little larger church now. I have been graced in both places that the church has given me an unlimited book fund. If I'm needed for study, they're going to provide it. And they were just gracious and in that regard, and it just fueled my, I needed to know. It just fueled my reading and research.
You were 17 when you became the pastor of the church.
So Evie Hill did my installation. At the end of the installation service, they're closing the service, taking up offering, making announcements, people giving remarks, make a presentation. Someone walks up. One of the ushers walk up to the pulpit. This is a true story. One of the ushers walks up to the pulpit and hands Dr. Evie Hill a note. He opens it. He interrupts whoever's talking and says, "I got to make an announcement. The usher just gave me a note and said we need to wrap this service up quickly because HB needs to be in the bed so he can get to school on time in the morning." True story. That usher was the vice principal of my school, L.A. High School. literally, buses from my church showed up at my graduation.
Wow.
So, I mean, I had my family there and these busloads at the sports arena near the Coliseum of church people there. Shouting that their pastor just graduated from high school. I'm not recommending any of this. This is just my testimony. I'm not recommending any of this.
You pastored there for 17, 18 years?
I pastored there for 18 years.
It must have been incredibly hard leaving to go across the country. And knowing that you were going to go into a situation where you had some challenges, can you share anything about that process? How did you pray through that? How did you make that decision?
The church in Jacksonville became vacant because of the moral failure of a pastor. There were legal implications to what happened. So it was not just a moral failure, it was a scandal that was being updated in the news every other day. And my predecessor, by the time they invited me, was in a court proceeding. He would end up going to prison. They invited me, very quickly. 5 blocks down Beaver Street from my church is First Baptist Church. Mac Brunson, who was the pastor then, paid for all of the deacons and the church leaders to come to the conference for free. They came and heard Vody Bakum, and the men determined that's our next pastor. And in the proceeding of these conversations, I asked Vody this last year. He verified that this was true. I just thought it was an urban legend. He wrote them a letter that was titled, 10 Reasons You Don't Want Vody Bakum to Be Your Pastor. And they agreed. But a couple of men really were so fond of him that they asked him for a list of men to hear. And the last guy on that list was a friend of mine who had just planted a church, and he would not come preach, but he says, the guy y'all are looking for is not on this list. He's in L.A., and you need to go invite him. So they invited me to preach, but by that time, they had already landed on their guy. And they were clear with me that it was nothing more than me filling the pulpit on holiday weekend for them, Memorial Day. And I was clear with them that I had no intention of being any way a part of this process. They called me to pastor the church 3 months later. And I had no intention of going. I was happy, content, and a blessed season in my church. I did not want anything to do with what was going on there in Jacksonville. And I really thought the Lord was punishing me. There's the stretch of my life. Quickly, I would just say that, you know, the death of my father was the hardest day of my life. But I could tell you the hardest day of my life is the day I had to go to that church in Los Angeles and tell them that I was leaving. It was just beloved congregation. And, you know, it is truly Philippians 1:3 thing for me. I thank my God upon every remembrance of that church. And they are regularly making pilgrimages to Jacksonville just to check on me. I am invited home every year to preach. I don't get a chance to preach anywhere else in Los Angeles. If I am there for a funeral or whatever, they insist that I come home to preach. So I end up preaching in my home church a couple of times a year. And I told the guys yesterday, every time I preach for them, I apologize for some of those sermons when I was learning to preach and they had to put up with. But they're still praying for me and encouraging me. It was I had no intention of leaving, ever leaving. The members of my church expected, there were old ladies who expected that my son would be the third pastor they had named H.B. Charles.
Wow.
And they just they just expected me to be there the long haul. Yep.
And your ministry at Shiloh, though evidently blessed and sustained by the Lord, hadn't been a walk in the park. I mean, you've had challenges there. You pulled two churches together, which is, I mean, in the best of circumstances, is a challenge.
Yep.
So share as freely as you want to about some of those challenges, because many of you, even if you go to relatively healthy churches, are going to face very discouraging challenges. So
the night I knew that the Lord was sending me to Jacksonville, I stayed up crying all night, praying all night. One question: what did I do wrong that you were sending me here? I just thought this was punishment. I was Job's friend in my own life, you know. There's got to be some secret sin, HB, in your life that you just need to come clean about, that the Lord has sent you into this. I'd never seen anything like this. And so my first years was the whole process of the scandal, We had a local broadcast, still do. And, you know, all of the Mac Brunson would go off and the station would say that what you just heard is not necessarily the opinions of CBS. We would go off and they would do breaking news to update my predecessor's court case. And we just had to live through, it was just very, very brutal. The church was hurt, embarrassed, shocked. The worst Sunday I've ever had to preach is the Sunday morning where that Saturday, the front page, full front page, is a big picture of my predecessor in handcuffs being led away to jail. And it's just the grief, just the palpable grief on the church. Worse than all of that, though, if I may, very quickly, worse than all of that is, he got out 3 years later and was called to pastor a church a mile away from us. And I would say about 500 people left and went with him. And I had to shepherd our church through that. And we're trying to make sense of eldership, church discipline, all of this. And in the middle of that, it all, that happens. Because of his legal situation, he could not come in a certain distance, be in a certain proximity of children. So there were some men who were dropping their children off for church at my church and going over there. I'd never seen anything like it. It's the most, and I had to serve through that. And because of the legal situations the church was in, I was very limited in what I could say publicly. And I just felt like I was forced to shepherd, in some regards, I felt like I was forced to shepherd a church with wolves coming and my hands were tied. And it was just a challenging season. That's why I am, though, the way I am. Because basically the tools I had at my disposal was prayer and the ministry of the word. And the Lord sustained us through that. If you come to our church, if you come to our city, 11 years in, none of the traces of that are evident. And when that's all that was talked about our church, there's a lot to say about our church before those things come up. And it's just been the sustaining grace of God. Really, it also, you know, I might have mentioned in one of the talks, just this season, I've always been committed to the first part of 2 Timothy 4, 2, preach the word. This experience has taught me to embrace the end of the verse, to do so with complete patience and teaching. And God has just proven himself faithful. I'm not sure if that was helpful.
No, that was very helpful. It's very helpful. HB, you've got a room full of folks preparing for the ministry. Some of them already in ministry. Are there things that you would like to emphasize to them that you've not had a chance to expound on, or maybe a theme that you have expounded on in your lectures that you'd like to elaborate and apply?
Nothing, unless someone has a specific question, nothing comes to mind except that the president asked me to say something about, I'm not the expert to say it, but he asked me to say something about illustration in preaching. He noted some of that I do. My father, I called him a storytelling preacher. He just illustrated well. He was eloquent. My father basically spent a lot of his week reading Charles Spurgeon sermons. And it was just a lot of imagery in his language. And he was eloquent in that regard, and it just seemed effortless. And I have tried to work at illustration, being succinct, clear, but I think it matters. I think, you know, expositional preaching gets a bad rap in some instances. But some of what is called expositional preaching is not actually exposition. And then the other problem is some of what is called expositional preaching ain't preaching. It's just some theological lecture. It's organized exegesis. But preaching is about communication of the truth. And I think being intentional and strategic, and even in being creative in how you prepare the messages, I think is important. In the beginning of my ministry, the principles for public speaking are very different than they are now. We live in the TED Talk culture now. And I just think some of the expectations and rules of communication have shifted. And I would just say, not being an expert on illustration and all of that, and I feel like it could be overdone, but I do think that you don't want to bore people with the gospel, and you don't want the preaching to be dry, and you want to put windows so that outside of the structure of this sermon, people can see how the truth works in the world around them. And in that regard, I think illustrations is putting windows in the house and pointing them out that window to show them how the truth works in life and in the world and in their experience. And I think that's a legitimate place. You don't want to build a house out of windows, but you don't want to build a house without windows. But what would you say about that, about illustration?
I've often been asked why I don't illustrate more. And mm-hmm. I tell people it's because I can illustrate my way out of a paper bag. So, I mean, honestly, that for me, that is the hardest part of sermon preparation. And the only thing that has helped me is listening to good expository preachers that do it well. Mm-hmm. Because it does not come naturally to me. And so I am listening all week long or stuff that's just happening in ordinary life to see if there's something that I can pick up from ordinary life to illustrate, you know, maybe not just the passage that I'm prepared to preach that Sunday, but some passage, you know, and just paying attention to ordinary life and conversation, because I think some of the best illustrations come from that, because everybody can relate to it. You know, we all have our favorite stuff that we like to talk about. You know, I've heard it's been said you get to use one Tolkien illustration a year, and then you put it up. You know, some people love J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, and I'm one of them. Yeah. But the world is divided into two groups. People who love J.R.R. Tolkien and people who hate J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, and your congregation is divided along those lines. And so if your illustrations every other week are coming from Tolkien, you're going to drive your people nuts. But, you know, illustration that comes out of, hey, you know, I was talking to a member of the congregation and they shared X. Everybody can relate to that. Just the normal stuff of life. So, I don't consider myself very good. I appreciate an expository preacher who knows how to illustrate. I'm just not one of them.
I would say two people that I read, I mentioned maybe yesterday, that I'm reading homiletical commentaries to get my arms around a text to see how other guys get their arms around it for preaching. I feel like two aids for me in that regard. Number one is James Montgomery Boyce, who does well at illustrating by using scripture.
Yeah.
And so I think you are still teaching.
True.
And he's not just quoting passages. He's using illustration to teach the truth of what of the text he's in. The other person who I benefit from reading in that regard is R. Kent Hughes. His sermons are just clean. And he's got, I mean, from history, from opera, but he's able to make it clean and understandable. And his writing, his preaching is succinct and clear. I just kind of want to read him to see how he gets at.
That's true.
At how he uses quotation well. And sometimes if you get a very good quotation, it can take the place of an illustration.
That's good.
And I think he does it well.
Very helpful. HB, you have a remarkable breadth of friendships. And those friendships are not contained to one particular tribe, as we like to say today. How did that happen? I mean, where does that develop in your life? That you're not just in the preaching circles of the churches in Los Angeles, but you've got all kinds of friendships. Tell us how that happened.
Yep. So, you know, I'm HB Jr. I'm kind of part of Baptist royalty in Los Angeles. That's kind of where I grew up. It's where my father served. My father did meetings around the country, and he did this citywide meeting with about 30 other preachers from different parts of the country every year in Oklahoma City. And I would always go with them. I would miss school for a week, actually, to go with them. And I was called to my dad's church. And the pastor he preached for, who was his best friend, who basically adopted me, John Reed, who's been 50 years now at Fairview Baptist Church in Oklahoma City. And he invited me to, in honor of my dad, that next year. And basically his people kept insisting that I keep coming. I kept coming there. I did that meeting for 20 years. But I remember when I got called to my daddy's church, and I'm preaching this, and they put me up for one of the mass events, the closing session. And they are finishing this service, and they say, the old pastor make an announcement, says, and Sunday our closing service will be preached by Junior. Stand up, Junior. And Greg Macon, some of these men were, at that time, they're 30s, 40s, they were the up-and-coming kind of guys in black church circles. They said, that's not his name. And when Steve Thurston got through giving his remarks, he had preached that night, he's from Chicago, Thurston said, I want to make a correction about y'all Sunday afternoon service. Junior will not be preaching that service. Reverend H.B. Charles Jr., the pastor of Mount Sinai Baptist Church in Los Angeles, will be preaching, and he deserves that respect. And these men from all around the country just kind of put their arms around me, and then they started preaching me. So I started in black church culture, started kind of getting a lot of different places. I am reading guys who might as well be Spurgeon and dead 150 years, because I never thought I'd ever meet John MacArthur. I'm in the back of his church. I have no expectation that I would meet any of these people. And I don't know by what means that just one door after another started opening in white evangelical settings. I could tell you what accelerated. I am preaching the pastor's conference for Mac Brunson. And my friend Keelan calls me that Monday and says, how did it go? I said, I don't know. All I know about this whole conference is that I just met Al Mohler. He's like, but how did the sermon go? I don't know. I met Al Mohler. He says, what did he say about your sermon? I said, he was kind. I said, but I think that's just Al Mohler. So I don't really know what he thought. And yeah, I got in the bed after that conversation, and I get in the bed, and my phone and iPad alerts, and my wife starts fussing. You are not in the hotel. Get these devices out of the bed. And putting them up, I check, and I get an email from Al Mohler's office asking me to do chapel.
Wow.
And pretty quickly after that, I'm in a lot of different circles.
Yeah.
And so I really don't know, I would say very quickly, I had a former youth pastor, Cameron Triggs in Orlando, who's a graduate of Reform there in Orlando. He just says he prays for me. He says, because, you know, he says, you're this unicorn in the middle of this intersection.
Yeah.
And all of these different tribes, you know, kind of claim you. And he's like, I just pray that the Lord will protect you from a collision in this intersection. But I don't know. I could tell you. I mean, I have National Baptist preachers, white evangelical pastors, Presbyterian pastors at this conference, and I could tell you, everyone I'm introducing, I could say these are my friends.
Right.
I'm not inviting names to a conference. These are friends, and I don't really know how that happened, but I'm grateful to God for His kindness.
Go back to what you were just describing a few minutes ago. Is you were really describing a culture of older pastors nurturing a younger pastor in the context of the National Baptist Convention.
Yep.
Is that still alive and well today, like it was when you were coming up in the ministry?
I would say the only difference that I see, the major difference, and it's a significant factor, it's just we live in the day of social media, YouTube, or whatever, and young preachers are trying to be, you know, YouTube sensations and stuff like that. But coming up, that just was in our setting. Learning from a legend. We were talking about him last night.
Jared Alcantara.
Jared Alcantara. He is at Truett Seminary now. It was at Trinity. Wrote Learning from a Legend, which I recommend, on the lessons from the ministry of Gardner Calvin Tamer.
Hmm.
Basically one of the major preaching voices of the last century of the black pulpit. But he talks about, you know, In white evangelical circles, there's an emphasis on formal education. And basically from Taylor, he's learning that in black culture, there's this apprenticeship that has basically been so central to training young men, including Gardner Taylor. And his argument at the end of that chapter is that he hopes in the future it will be more of a marriage in the training of men. Both that formal scholarship and the apprenticeship of older men. And I just... That has been the tradition of black church culture, and it still is. And I mean, I just, as a young preacher, I could not get mad at you as my pastor and go somewhere in Los Angeles and join somebody else's church. Hey, aren't you from Liggs Church?
Hmm.
No. It was just a tight knit.
Wow.
And there were these men watching over us. And there was this mentoring thing that I still think is very, very, in more ways than I think I see in a white church.
Absolutely.
Because
that's why I'm asking.
In a black church, black churches get vacant and they are going to call respected older men for a recommendation.
Right.
There's no, it's not, they're going to a seminary or or denominational thing, yeah. they are going to ask the mature men, yes. is there somebody you can commend to me? And so though that the relationships in our culture just are big, and I just benefited from it. It is the way, I feel like it shaped the way I am. I feel like I'm trying to find ways to give back.
Yeah.
I do some interviews that I may find some of them on YouTube or on a website. But basically, a lot of these interviews are with men who, when I was young, from around the country, met me, kept up with me, invested in me, and I benefited from so much private time with them. I just, like, if I could spend an hour and let some young preacher who will never get in the room with them, you know, just kind of glean from their wisdom, I feel like I'm partially paying back the investment that's made in me. But that is real rich in the
I mean, that's just something for you all to bear in mind. It won't be that long before you're the guys with 15 years of ministry under your belt. And, you know, if somebody poured into you, pour it back into somebody else. And if they didn't pour it into you, pour it into them anyway. You know, I mean, just, I do think that's a 1 Timothy and Titus thing. You know, Paul tells us we're always supposed to be on the lookout for people who are uniquely gifted to shepherd the flock. And we're supposed to be investing in them as well as in the flock. You know, faithful men, discipling faithful men who will disciple the flock. And so that's got to be on your radar screen. And I do know, I think there is enough individualism in Presbyterian culture, you know, Southern Baptist culture, you know, American Anglican culture, that a lot of times we think that's somebody else's job to do. And I have been impressed. I was impressed seeing the men that you had there together at Cutting It Straight. It's clear that they had relationships with one another. And they not only supported one another, and vocally so, during the preaching, mm-hmm. you could tell that actually flowed out of real relationships that were maintained all over the country
yep.
as these guys pastored in various places. And then you tell a story of those same kinds of folks investing in you. And I wish that, you know, in another generation, your sons in the ministry could give a similar kind of testimony. That, man, there were five guys that were looking out for me, and they were pouring into me. And I think sometimes we just get busy, and we're thinking about other stuff. We get in our little silo in our church, and we got enough, you know, fish to fry in our own city, and we're not thinking about those guys. And all of us ought to be doing that. Because, I mean, HB had a great father, but then he lost his father at 17. And there were other people that became father figures. All of us need that, whether we had a good, godly father at home or not. And, you know, I can look back in my own life, and I can give that testimony. I lost my dad at 32, so I had my dad a lot longer than you did. But I had a lot of godly men that the Lord put in my life that have made a huge difference to me. And one thing that men getting involved in your life gives you is a sense of security. And insecurity is one of the most dangerous things in ministry. It'll get you, it will get you so fast. Because you are going to have people going after you in ministry your whole life. And if you're insecure about that, you'll be paranoid, and you will not be a good shepherd. But if you're secure, and of course that starts with trusting the Lord. But I've just found when a man has had a man invest in his life, it strengthens his ability to be secure in times of trial. Have you found that, David?
I heard a pastor say when I was a young man, you are not a man until there is a man in your life that you are submitting to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I took that seriously. In black church culture, I would say, I hate to keep making that comparison, but it is a thing that guys want to know, who is your pastor?
That's good.
And at 46, whatever people think about my ministry, that is in our culture still a thing. Who is your pastor? And my pastor has been my pastor now for a very long time. To be honest, I lived a couple of miles from him in Los Angeles. And in the early years of my marriage, it really helped me and my young bride marriage that my wife was convinced that if I did something, she could go up there and tell on me. and I would be held accountable by my pastor.
That's good.
I have been the beneficiary of that, and it really matters, even at this stage. And to have the friends, which takes the work of cultivating, but, you know, whatever people see online or whatever,
right.
I have friends who, if I do something, they're going to call and like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
That's good.
And they're going to ask me tough questions. Challenge me, and it matters that you're developing those friendships, that you are. I would also say that men like Dr. Moeller and you and Mark, the development of you all's friendship and just kind of your care for me, I preached the closing message at the conference the night without, and I couldn't sleep that night. I just felt like I didn't do a good job. I worked hard on it, and I didn't feel like I did a good job. And I called Lynn. He just landed, and he was gracious and kind and directing some of the counsel he gave me. I called Dave Helm.
Oh, wow.
After I called you.
Yeah.
And Dave said, HB, he listened when I, to me, and when I finished, he said, HB, you are a preacher on Monday morning, and I don't talk to preachers on Monday morning. but just to have someone be able to make those phone calls, it matters. Yeah.
It does matter. Thank you, HB. No, we really appreciate it.
Thank you, brother.
HB has some place to get to, but if you want to come up and speak, we'll be here for a couple of minutes.